Hey, how's it going? Welcome back to another episode of the Super Mercado Brothers Video Game Music Podcast.
How's it going, everyone? This is Carl Brueggemann.
And this is his brother, Will Brueggemann. Today we have a very exciting episode, one that Carl and I have been talking about doing for a really long time.
Definitely. The topic for today is inspiration and influences. This is really exciting. Today we're going to be playing music that has inspired and influenced video game music. This is a really cool topic that I don't think has been touched on, to my knowledge, really anywhere. So I think this will be an exciting topic to kind of break some new ground on.
Yeah, you're going to be hearing all music that is not actually from video games, but music that inspired video game music as we know it today. And to join us here today on this exciting adventure, we have once again Marty Brueggemann.
Hi guys, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely, it's great to be with you again, Marty. So this is going to be definitely a nice change of pace, and hopefully we'll be able to put a nice historical perspective on video game music and kind of where it came from. I think a lot of you will get a real kick out of this, because a lot of this music you may not have heard of before, and even if you have, you may have never thought about the connection of how it's related to video game music and a lot of the most prolific composers in the world of video game music. So this should be a very good time. What you heard playing in with was a piece by Johann Strauss that was an excerpt from Blue Danube, and hopefully you guys got a little taste in some of the melodic similarities to the Super Mario Underwater theme. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice hearing some of those pitzes in the basses.
Right.
In that kind of a waltz figure, and it's interesting to think of how composers like Koji Kondo would use 8-bit instruments to try to simulate those orchestral pizzas. It's really nice.
Yeah, so I'm just really excited to start this episode off. It's kind of cool. Today is not only the first episode where we're playing music that isn't in a video game, but that's all we're playing today. We're actually...
The only other episode that came close was when we did that remix episode a few months back.
Right. Very true.
But yeah, don't change that channel, guys. I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast.
So one thing we're going to do today is we're going to play music in a chronological order, and it's going to be kind of a nice trip through music history. So we're going to go way back all the way to the medieval period, and this was a piece that was composed in the 1200s by Alfonso X, who was a Spanish king in the 1200s. Pretty crazy. He actually composed quite a bit of music. There's a book of songs called Cantigas de Santa Maria, which is songs to the Virgin Mary, which is all attributed to this king of Spain or maybe modern-day Portugal. So we're going to play a track. This is a medieval piece of music. It is called Cantiga 166, and this is performed by Vox Velgaris. Listening to a medieval piece of music called Cantiga 166, and this was composed in the 1200s. So this was composed by King Alfonso X, and he was the king of Spain from 1252 until 1284. So at some point in there, he composed this piece.
Cool.
So, pretty cool. It's cool that you hear all the kind of the pirate influences that, you know, we had that recently. We had that pirate episode.
Yeah, well,
it's kind of the origins of it all.
Yeah, it's really nice. You get sort of that classic Dorian mode that we love so much, and we really notice on so much video game music, and this piece in particular is really applicable to this topic that we're having here today for multiple reasons. One, as we mentioned, that Dorian mode, that's a mode that's used in a lot of video game music to evoke that timeless quality, that sort of of a different era quality.
Well, there's a lot of games, Final Fantasy, RPG games that take place in like an older time.
Right.
So they're trying to go back to this kind of classic
sound. Yeah, they're evoking a medieval type of age. But also, I feel like a lot of modern games like World of Warcraft or some of those pirate games that we talked about actually use this exact same type of instrumentation with the lute and what have you.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear this because many of us don't really listen to a lot of music, original music from this period.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We hear this style in films that are set in that period or also video games that are set in that period. And it's really nice to listen to an original piece of music and to notice that, hey, a lot of these composers that imitate this style are doing a pretty nice job of bringing us back into that world.
Definitely. It's pretty cool. As far as the notation in this era, the only thing that is really clear about the type of notation that has survived are the notes, so the actual pitches. They don't really know the rhythmic value. So what's kind of interesting is there's some different versions of this piece, and I heard one version that was very rubato. And so rhythmically, it's kind of anyone's guess. They kind of base it on other things, but yeah, melodically this was composed by Alfonso X in the 1200s. So
yeah, the evolution of sheet music is really important in the development of music in general. It's sort of, if anyone that plays guitar might be familiar with a form of notation called tablature. Mm-hmm. And in tablature, it's not always clear what the rhythm of that music is either, and it's kind of handed down, or the music is already known and understood by the person that's reading it. So that was probably a similar situation for musicians that played this piece.
Definitely. Well, that was fun. We're going to jump way ahead into the Baroque period, and this is a piece by Bach. This is one of his inventions. Now, Bach made a lot of inventions, and he wrote those for his students, so they're definitely fairly simple pieces. The inventions are actually just two-part piano pieces, and what's cool is you're going to hear some similarities to 8-bit music, because we definitely hear a lot of 8-bit music that is three-part, but there are some two-part 8-bit songs, so this is going to be a nice example of some of the influences of early video game music. So let's take a listen to Invention number 13 by Johann Sebastian Bach. Listening to Invention number 13, composed by Johann Sebastian Bach and performed by Jano Sebastian.
Yeah, one thing that's really important about this piece and a lot of Bach's piano literature is that, as Carl mentioned with his inventions, it relies on those two voices. But what's really nice is he really is right in saying that this is influential to the writing of 8-bit music, the way that those instruments were voiced. Even if the composers weren't necessarily directly inspired by this type of music, and in some cases they were, that type of writing requiring you to create full chord sounds using a limited number of voices required some of these techniques. As you probably noticed, like the separation between the bass and melody changes throughout this piece. You get a lot of that do-do-do-do-do for the bass and the melody moving, but there's also times when they sort of occupy similar space and work as those sort of offsetting descending arpeggios.
Well, if you're not just talking about video game music, but music in general, I mean, Bach was the pioneer of all those techniques and kind of laid the foundation of all the rules that we all follow in kind of Western common practice. So, I mean, it makes sense that we're going to start with Bach today, you know?
Yeah. And also what's great about his inventions is that you have a lot of really nice moments of canon where you have an idea in the upper voice and then it's imitated by the lower voice.
Right.
And vice versa. And I mean, he's just a master of creating these melodies that independently are very moving. When the two voices are combined, there's some really beautiful harmonic moments that happen. And these pieces really have stood the test of time,
right.
Not only for their educational value, but musically, they've also endured just because they're wonderful pieces of music.
And one thing that's kind of an interesting thought is that a lot of people, when they're little kids, take piano lessons. Yuzo Koshiro comes to mind, is a video game composer that studied classical music. It's possible some of these composers may have played these Bach inventions when they were young. So who's to say if that seeped into their brain in some way?
It would actually be pretty shocking if they hadn't had exposure to,
right.
to Bach music when they were studying the piano.
Really cool. Well, once again, we're going to jump ahead in time to the music of Scott Joplin. Pretty much created ragtime, so we're going to play a couple of his pieces because ragtime is one of the genres that has influenced video game music the most. We're going to start things off with one of his most well-loved rags. This is Maple Leaf Rag, composed by Scott Joplin. You're listening to Maple Leaf Rag, composed by Scott Joplin, and this is performed by Richard Zimmerman. You definitely hear a lot of video game influences here, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, this is just such an iconic melody and song. I feel this is the type of thing that I can really bank on. Everyone has heard this at some point or another. And a lot of Joplin's music is, again, just like that, incredibly iconic. Things such as, like, The Entertainer. But one thing that's so wonderful about ragtime music when it relates to how it influenced video game music, this is another example of using music as a means to be creative with limitations. Because at the time this music was written, the whole design of it was intended to use the full range of the piano to a point that it could cut out in as many frequencies as possible, and it could cut out over loud rooms.
Over loud chatter. Right.
Yeah, and what's so great, you hear in a lot of ragtimes, especially Scott Joplin's, you have that very moving left hand. You get a lot of movement in his pieces. You have a lot of octave movement, and he'll do a low octave and then come up and bounce. And it's nice because there's a lot of classical influence to that. But in general, Joplin's chord structure, the way in which he creates those chord progressions, was very sort of early, like, jazzy and kind of poppy for the time, and that to me is, I think, one of the biggest influences of Koji Kondo's music when it comes to the specific sounds of chords that he uses.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot has been said about the Scott Joplin influence on composers like Koji Kondo, but ragtime captures such an interesting period in the history of music because it's sort of this bridging of European harmony of the time and some of the emerging blues inflections,
right.
And, you know, African influenced rhythms that are happening in America.
It's just about to completely bust open. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also reminded of video game music in a way, sort of like Will is saying, this is designed to use the full extent of the piano, and it's really designed to be a one-man band.
Exactly. Yeah, so really the influence of Scott Joplin can't be overstated. We're going to play one more track by Joplin. This is a tune called Solace.
Thank you.
This is Solace, composed by Scott Joplin. And I believe this is composed around the year 1909. So very early 20th century music right here.
Yeah, it's so interesting because the subtitle of this piece, it's Solace, and then it's called A Mexican Serenade. Mm. And what's funny is the chords still feel very vintage Joplin, but it is having that sort of more Latin American rhythmic quality to it. And what's interesting is going back to somebody like Koji Kondo, he would do that a lot. I feel like one of his big things, whenever he would take things like Latin or different types of world music like that, it would still have his own unique sensibility as far as chords. And I feel a lot of that is owed to Scott Joplin. But what's funny is hearing those two sensibilities collide in this piece really reminds me of something like the Mario 3 end credits, or yeah, even like the Mario 1 overworld, of like mixing like Latin American ideas with sort of like bluesy, jazzier ideas as far as like chords.
Specifically about this piece, there's so much nostalgia in this piece, and that's something that is always right in the music of Koji Kondo. So that's something that really relates the two to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that you really notice in this piece and a lot of Joplin's writing is a lot of this harmony in thirds with a lot of chromaticism.
Exactly.
And that is something, you know, let's say the Mario 3 athletic overworld theme, very similar kind of writing in Koji Kondo. I know we're talking a lot about Koji Kondo, but the Joplin influence, the ragtime influence, does go further than just his work in video games.
Well, it's kind of earlier how we said it's hard to not talk about Bach. It's hard to not talk about Kondo is the origins of video game music. So there's kind of a parallel there, because obviously there were composers that came after Bach that were inspired by him and influenced by him. And I think the same could be said for Kondo.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of composers who tried to emulate his style. And even if we were just looking at like the Mario franchise in particular, so many composers at that time or around that time and since then have really tried to emulate that style. And I think a lot of them have gone back to the source material, like Katsumi Tataka as an example in Super Mario Land 2, and that end credits theme. This really feels sort of like a combination of like the Scott Joplin type of sensibility.
So we really recommend that you guys check out this entire piece, because it's a little bit long, so we're not going to play the whole thing. And in general, every single track we're playing today will be listed on our blog, so if something really stands out to you, feel free to head over to our blog and you'll be able to find it there.
Yeah, the last movement in particular of this piece is just gorgeous, so you definitely will want to check it out.
Cool. Well, we're going to move ahead about 20 years or so. This is a piece by George Gershwin, and I think this piece was composed in the 20s, maybe late 20s. This is a piano piece called Sweet and Lowdown, and this is actually a piano roll, so this was performed by George Gershwin himself. This piece is really cool because there's a point that you reach in this piece where you're going to be like, oh man, that does sound like video game music, and then there's another point, and it's almost ridiculous how much this sounds like video game music. So let's take a listen to Sweet and Lowdown. That is so cool. This was Sweet and Lowdown, composed and performed by George Gershwin. How about that last section, that really demonic section? It feels like a boss theme, doesn't it?
What I love about listening to a piece like this is it kind of challenges our conceptions about music and the history of music.
Exactly.
You know, when you'd hear some of those harmonic things, let's say in kind of a contemporary video game or contemporary film score, it sounds edgy, it sounds new, it sounds daring. What's cool is that it's daring here in Gershwin, and it's forever daring. It somehow has not dated.
That's a really good point, Marty.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I like how thematic this piece is, and it returns to themes and ideas and loops similarly to how an old 16-bit theme would. And in general, it has that sort of range of emotions, which also reminds me of video game music, because it's very blatant, exaggerated emotions. You have a very saturated happiness, and then you sort of have that darker, very classic sounding, as Carl described it, as demonic kind of melody. It kind of reminds me of...
It sounds a lot like In the Hall of the Mountain King,
right,
by Grieg. And he may actually even be intentionally quoting that here.
Mm-hmm.
I really like what you're getting at, Will, and I think we'll notice that in all of the musical examples of the first half of the 20th century that we're going to listen to, is that all of the emotions are extreme. You could say even kind of theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
The contrast is really strong. So it's when it's fun, it's a lot of fun. When it's scary, it's so scary that the villain is twirling his mustache.
Yeah. That's really cool. Well, we're going to move on to a tango piece, probably the most famous tango of all time. And this was composed in, I believe, the early 30s. This was composed by Carlos Gardel, and this was made famous in the movie Scent of a Woman. This is Por Una Cabeza. Listening to the classic Por Una Cabeza, composed by Carlos Gardel.
What a beautiful piece of music. This has definitely stood the test of time. And it's nice being able to hear this in our timeline of music that we're listening to today. We can hear some connective tissue with this in Scott Joplin. Mm-hmm. You know, in Solace, Joplin was basically acknowledging that it had Latin American influence. And south of the border, there was that same kind of... cross-pollination that was going on,
right,
with the harmonies of the time and rhythms that were part of that culture.
One thing that is so cool is this chorus, like this main, the most famous part of the piece, the chords are just so present in a lot of video game music. I think of a lot of Japanese composers, like Falcom stuff. I mean, I don't know, you hear that chord progression so much, and it's just, it's crazy. When you get to that chorus and you actually think about it, it really kind of opens your eyes as to how influential this type of music was to video game composers.
I think what's important to note with music of this period, this piece does actually have lyrics to it as well. This is a piece that could be sung. But what's so great about music of this era is even vocal music was so melodic, so tuneful, that when you give it to the orchestra, it's lush and beautiful, and the melodies just stand on their own. Now, video game composers have a similar mandate where the melodies of their work really need to carry the music, and we're hearing that in these examples, definitely.
Definitely. Now we're going to move on to something that I'm probably the most excited about that we're playing today, and it's possible that a lot of you guys may have never heard this before.
Yeah. What we're going to listen to is a medley of some music that appeared in a lot of the short films from Hal Roach Studios. That was a studio that produced the films of Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang, which later became known as The Little Rascals. Any of you that grew up watching some of those films may recognize some of this music. Now, what's fascinating about this music is there hasn't been a lot written about this music and its influence on the culture. And another thing is that the composer of most of it, and actually the composer of all the pieces we're going to hear today, was largely uncredited. That is, his music appeared in many of these films without him receiving screen credit.
Right.
So the music we're listening to today was composed by a man named Leroy Shield. Now, we don't know for certain what the influence of this music was specifically on video game composers. It's likely that they may have heard the music, but beyond that, what I think is fascinating is that Leroy Shield found himself in a very similar situation that a lot of the early video game composers did, in that he's writing short pieces of music that are very melodic. Mm-hmm. They have to be memorable. They're used a lot. They're used in a lot of films. So people are going to hear them again and again, and they can't get tired of them. That's something that we've heard from other video game composers.
Right.
They're trying to write melodic music that doesn't get tiring. That's something that Leroy Shield is doing here. And also, because he's not writing for specific scenes, it's similar to how video game composers, they aren't able to predict the actions of the player. So they're writing for environments. And so it's interesting that the circumstances are so similar, and the music in many ways is similar too.
I think you guys will get a real kick out of this. This is a Hal Roach medley composed by Leroy Shield.
Some things that you should listen out for is a little snippet of music that would be at home in like a dungeon or cave level of a video game, a piece of music that sounds like it could be like a bonus stage, and then the very last snippet you'll hear sounds almost like a level complete.
Oh, nice.
Here we go. That was a Hal Roach medley, music composed by Leroy Shield. That was so much fun. Hopefully you guys got a kick out of that.
Yeah, what's great about this music, and you might not be able to tell from the medley, is that these are all very short pieces of music, 1 to 2 minutes long in most cases. And so there isn't a lot that we're leaving out. So it's very similar to a lot of early video game music where it's looped, where it's a short piece of music, right, but it can sustain repetition so well.
That's a really good point, Marty.
We're going to move on to a Cole Porter song. This is a very famous show tune called Begin the Begin. And this particular version is sung by the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. Let's take a listen to Begin the Begin, composed by Cole Porter.
When they begin the begin, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars, and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the palms seem to be swaying when they begin.
This is Begin the Begin, composed by Cole Porter and sung by Ella Fitzgerald. You hear a lot of melodic and harmonic influences to video game music in this piece. We talk a lot in the podcast about, oh, that sounds show-tune-y, and this is kind of where that all came from, so it's cool to actually go to the origins of that.
Yeah, the legacy of music written for the stage, or what we sometimes call show-tune music, is huge in American music. So I know sometimes when these guys reference show tune music, you might be thinking of kind of a narrow set of music, kind of some show tunes cliches, but we're really talking about the legacy that does go back to Cole Porter, does go back to Gershwin,
right,
Richard Rodgers, and so forth.
Yeah, I think we're specifically talking about the people in that early era of show tune music, like the Porters and like Rodgers and Hammerstein and things like that. One thing I just love about Cole Porter's music is it's always very fun and lively, but one thing that I really like is he's just a very, very creative lyricist. Every single one of his songs, there's always something really creative. If you really take the lyrics, there's really clever wordplay, and there's always a really sort of nice use of imagery. As saturated as the melodies are with like emotion, I feel like the lyrics are as saturated with imagery and colorful ideas.
Yeah, it definitely gives you a great sense of the period.
Right.
One thing is, it didn't quite make the cut, but we wanted to play a Glenn Miller piece, and this kind of does fit it because it has big band in it, but the big band era, a lot of the romantic music of the big band era, like specifically Moonlight Serenade, which didn't quite make the cut on today's episode, but that music was very influential. We did talk about it on our romantic music episode, but very influential to Final Fantasy, a lot of the romance themes. In general, a lot of the times composers wanted to do something kind of romantic. A lot of that came from this era, so it's kind of nice that we can go back to the roots of it all. We're going to move ahead about 20 years once more to a Latin piece. And now we talked about Latin before, and if you ask Koji Kondo, and people have, what kind of music do you listen to? I think he pretty much says, I listen to jazz and Latin music. So we're going to play a Latin piece of music. This is by Machito, who was one of the most legendary forces in the Latin music world. Let's play a piece called Mambo Scope, and this is recorded in the late 50s. Let's take a listen. Listening to Mambo Scope by Machito and his Afro-Cubans. this is a nice kind of microcosm of Latin music. And really, it kind of is undeniable. Latin music is all over video game music. Probably the first thing that comes to mind, if you would ask the childhood Carl, what's an example of a Latin piece of music in video games? I would say the menu theme of Sonic 3. And I think that is one of the more famous uses of Latin music. But it's really all over the Sonic games and all over the 16-bit era of video game music. And even a more recent example would be Rayman Origins has a lot of authentic Latin music in it.
And it really appears in a lot of different styles of video game music. In racing games.
Exactly.
You know, to kind of party games. You know, and across a lot of different developers.
Mario Kart, it's all over the place.
The cool thing about Latin is that those rhythms really can be so transcendent. And a really cool thing, especially in video games, I mentioned this before, but with video game music, you get a lot of clashing and collaboration of different genres of music. And I feel like a lot of game composers pick from different periods in music history and blend them together. And something about the technological sounds of the hardware on the old school systems that they were using sort of blend all those different influences together.
What I think is nice about listening to these pieces in sequence today is that we're hearing, even for music of this time, it's still a fusion.
Right.
There are a combination of influences that are happening at the same time, and that's something that's always been a part of video game music as well.
It's almost like this long-running game of telephone that the world is playing, because you're getting a little bit of these different influences here and there, and they're going to different things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful in all of this 20th century music. It's so unabashedly tuneful, and the harmonies are exciting. And now we're getting to a point in time where pretty much every aspect of the music is exciting. The rhythms are exciting. The harmonies are exciting. The melodies are exciting.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was so much happening in the 20th century. Like, if you look at what happened to classical music, it really branched off in so many different huge, like, sectors. I mean, you have minimalism, atonalism, polytonalism, like, all kinds of different camps of music. And in addition to that, you have, you know, the birth of jazz and ragtime and all these really creative and expressive different genres that it's really kind of an interesting point in music, because you have so much music and like the rise of popular music also. And I think it's just, it's a really nice thing, because we're doing with this episode, going from, you know, jumping 20 years ahead and whatnot, you can hear all these little influences from periods of the past. And I think that's one really cool thing that musicians can do, is learn from the past and sort of take their own experiences and put a little bit of themselves into it.
Yeah, it feels like we were just on a vacation on Koopa Troopa Beach, but we're going to snap back to reality here and we're going to move on. Now, this is really fun. Now, another genre that is incredibly influential to video games is jazz fusion, music of the 70s. So what happened is some of these jazz musicians wanted to just do a lot of synthesizers were on the rise, and some of these guys got a little too excited and carried away and just wanted to use these synth sounds like all the time. So jazz fusion is definitely doesn't hold up quite as much as maybe some other music of that era, but definitely you hear a lot of similarities to video game music. And I do know for a fact that a lot of video game music composers listen to jazz fusion and even incorporate it in their soundtrack. So let's take a listen to a piece by Return to Forever, which is probably one of the most famous jazz fusion groups of all time. This is a piece called Medieval Overture off the album Romantic Warrior, and this came out in 1976. Let's take a listen to Medieval Overture. Listening to Medieval Overture by Return to Forever off the album Romantic Warrior. And it's pretty undeniable, the influences here. On a superficial level, the sounds you're hearing of those synthesizers really do sound video gamey. But really, the influence of this cannot be overstated. I think one thing that's interesting is Marty and I were talking about this when we were playing this track, is the lifespan of jazz fusion was very short-lived, in the scheme of things, at least in America. But what's interesting is in Japan, it kind of had a longer lifespan, and a lot of these composers would be listening to this music a lot later, and it kind of lived on in other capacities. One would be video game music. So it's kind of cool that this music has lived on in other forms, because jazz fusion is definitely something that some people roll their eyes at. As far as jazz goes, I mean, a lot of people just kind of, you know, cringe that was maybe kind of one of the dark periods of jazz. Other people love it, you know.
It's the disco of jazz.
Exactly. It is the disco of jazz. But some monster playing here. I mean, the drumming on this track is absolutely insane. So, there's a lot of ridiculous playing here. I think some of it is just a little bit kind of obnoxious, maybe, but yeah, you just can't say enough how influential this is to video game music. You hear Rockman and Forte influence. You hear just so much 16-bit era influence here.
Isn't it funny how a piece from the 70s can feel a little bit more dated than something from the 1200s?
It's so interesting, yeah.
That's a really wonderful point, Marty. I think it's just about that we've sort of advanced the sounds of synthesizers, and that sort of evolved into like sampling, where when we listen to the music from the 1200s, I feel like we're just listening to the music in and of itself, and like the actual sounds that we're hearing feel maybe a little bit more natural than like something like this. It's sort of like getting in that awkward space because you have the real instruments sort of clashing with the electronic ones.
There's not a lot of taste in this era of jazz fusion. I mean, like I said, they were getting really excited with this new possibility, these synthesizers, and they were going overboard with it. But it's cool that like synth is still really big, and video game music is probably one of the biggest genres where that is just king. I mean, I just can't get enough of using synth leads and synthesizers in my music. So
yeah, and I think what we're going to see in some of the following examples, and including the most recent track that we just listened to, is kind of the increasing value of the keyboardist in a lot of these groups. And that was definitely something that appealed to a lot of these keyboard-based composers who ended up working on video games. So it's not surprising that a lot of their favorite bands were bands that had keyboardists. And actually, in a lot of those bands, a lot of the music is kind of driven by the keyboard player, sometimes written by the keyboard player. So we're starting to see some harmonies, some melodic ideas in this music that was, you know, really appreciated by a lot of the video game composers.
Now, one interesting thing about today's episode is in the course of our podcast, and I would say video game music in general, it's definitely dominated by Japanese composers. But what's interesting today is the music that we're playing is dominated by Western composers. And I think that's kind of an interesting point. And we're going to keep that train rolling here because we've talked about ragtime, we've talked about show tunes, jazz fusion. Now we're going to talk about American film music. We're going to move on to John Williams. We're going to play a piece from Superman. This is the main title march composed by John Williams. You're listening to the Superman main title march composed by John Williams and performed by the London Symphony Orchestra.
God, that's just such a wonderful piece of music. Every time I listen to that, I think about the story that Richard Donner told, who directed the Superman movie, He said when they were at the recording studio recording this, he ruined the first take because as soon as that main theme started, after, you know, those kind of rhythmic strings are building the suspense, as soon as that started, he said, "I swear you could hear the orchestra saying Superman." And, you know,
that's
it's
funny.
It's doing everything it needs to accompany this movie.
Right. It definitely set a standard for what is rousing music and what is like a hero theme. And when you think about Legend of Zelda, the main theme, there's no question that that was inspired by the music of John Williams. And we've talked about it in the past, and there's a lot of other games and soundtracks that are obviously inspired by this because these movies were huge, and I think a lot of this music was popular not only in America, which was the case with a lot of the music that we've played today, is even though it is American, it was definitely loved all around the world.
Well, and the thing is, Johnny had the really fortunate opportunity of scoring, and I think fortunate for everyone involved, of scoring such classic parts of people's childhoods and just things that really seeped into pop culture, like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park and E.T. And even to this day with things like Harry Potter, all of those sort of enterprises that he sort of put his name on really spread and became universal. So his music and his unique style of melody and orchestration really was influential for like decades to come.
Absolutely. And what you're hearing now, those ostinatos in the low strings, those are very influential to film scores of the period up to this day and to video game music. We hear a lot of rhythmically exciting bass ostinatos
in Zelda,
boss music in Zelda Overworld, for instance, and a lot of Overworld main themes.
And that's a good point.
And not to say that John Williams invented that, you know, but he made such great use of it.
He made it popular.
He kind of brought it back into the consciousness.
And in general, symphonic music, in general, that's what he did with it.
Right, and using those orchestration techniques to create this type of connotation, I feel like the people like to use examples of like, oh, this type of thing has been done before. But before Johnny, no one put all those things together to create that emotion.
And at this time, it wasn't pop. It wasn't in the pop culture, and now it is. Now everyone is singing this orchestral music. In a couple of years before that, they weren't. They were singing, I don't know what they were singing, some sort of, you know, disco song, probably.
And the thing to note when you're listening to this symphonic music is that, yeah, maybe you're reminded of romantic symphonic music, you know, older classical or romantic period music. But the harmonies that are present there and the rhythms that are present there, you don't really find that in 18th century European music.
Yeah, you have those
music.
Really sort of almost like jazzy, extended like harmonies.
So we're going to move ahead to the 80s, of course. You can't talk about video game music influences without talking about the 80s. This is actually the decade that we're going to end on today, but we have a few more fun pieces to play for you. We're going to play a song by Huey Lewis and the News. This was their first hit single. This is a song called Do You Believe in Love? And one kind of interesting thing about this track is the bass tone of this song kind of feels like Genesis a little bit, and in general just kind of the songwriting and the chord choices, it really feels like early video game music. It's very poppy.
Yeah, when you get to that chorus, imagine 8-bit or 16-bit instruments playing that tune, and I think you'll start smiling.
Do You Believe in Love? This is Do You Believe in Love by Huey Lewis and the News.
Yeah, that song was written by Mutt Lange, the legendary producer.
Nice job, Mutt. Yeah, definitely you hear a lot of Genesis sounds in this, like type of sounds, like that we talked about the bass sound, but in general, just the way that this melody is used over the chords, this really would be at home in a lot of Sega Genesis music. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of goofy, and it's one of those things that, again, I think most people wouldn't really think about it in that context or really give it the time of day. But when you actually think about it, like if I were to sequence this in VOPM, I think the results would be pretty surprising to people.
Yeah, and I think it's important to be aware of the context of the musical landscape when a lot of these composers were kind of developing all of their chops.
Exactly. I mean, this is so vintage 80s, and it's very unabashed. Like, even the lyrics, like, do you believe in love? Like, all that sort of, like, powerful, romantic, like, in-your-face kind of talk. It reminds me of things like, you know, Back to the Future.
It's funny you just said different. Vintage 80s as the sax solo comes in. Sorry, I wanted to say that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool because, like Marty said, is when a lot of this video game music really started to pop up, and we hear certain chord progressions carried over from a lot of 80s pop music into video games. That's sort of, it's because that was around at the same time.
Well,
like,
almost
that
more
was modern
so
at that
than
point.
Any other music that we've played so far, it's undeniable that the people that composed these games in the 80s, this was the music that was popular at the time. So it's impossible for this to not have some sort of conscious, subconscious influence on them. Especially someone who was a young video game composer, you know. So I think it's kinda interesting.
Right.
And we're gonna play a couple more very, very famous 80s pop songs. We're gonna move on to Eye of the Tiger by Survivor. Now this piece is definitely kind of a lot of the inspiration of something like Street Fighter, a little bit of Mega Man in general, a lot of early 8-bit and early 16-bit games.
Now I feel like this deserves, I feel like it's kind of, you know, badass enough to maybe deserve not being called a piece. I think we can call this one a song.
Without any further ado, this is Eye of the Tiger by Survivor.
Even think we need to say what this piece is. I think it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, just a little backstory. This really became an incredibly popular song via the movie Rocky III.
Right.
I've said a lot in the podcast. I remember the first time on like the Castlevania episode, or especially when we talked about Yoko Shimomura, that a lot of the music definitely felt inspired by like 80s sort of montage music. And this is really what I was referring to, is that sort of like, you know, the style of like really melodic music but still trying to be like hard rock at the same time, but it feels really kind of white and dorky at the same time, but they're really, you know, it's trying to build this sort of I don't know, like machismo of like being really macho and stuff.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, and this is like the holy grail of that like workout music.
Yeah.
Well, if you thought this was even remotely influential to the music of Street Fighter, then this next piece is going to blow your top. This is by Cheap Trick. Now, this is not the type of sound that I think of when I think of Cheap Trick. This is a little bit later. This was part of the Top Gun soundtrack, and that film came out in 1985. Let's take a listen to a song called Mighty Wings. This is Mighty Wings by Cheap Trick from the soundtrack Top Gun, which came out in 1985. One thing kind of to note here is that although we're playing a lot of American music, Top Gun and a lot of this movie music we're playing were international hits. So this was very popular all around the world, not just in America. And I think it's funny, I mean, when you start the song, Can I Get Ken Stage? It's just incredibly similar to Ken Stage. Yeah. What I think is kind of ironic is that this wasn't the music to Guile Stage, because the theme of Guile Stage is kind of that Top Gun feel. So I think it's funny that this was put in Ken Stage.
Well, and one thing that I think is kind of cool is I even get way more video game sounds, and I can think of specific examples that feel influenced by this to me. One is in Mega Man 7, the melody of this chorus really reminds me of the opening stage. Like, if you remember the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, there's a melody that goes do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-
because as you listen to this song, you can hear the sound of the drum set, for instance, reminds us of SNES, reminds us of Genesis.
Sega.
And it's a really good context to remember when they were making drum samples for their video games, these are the kind of sounds that they were trying to emulate.
Exactly. No, that's a really good point, Marty. I mean, a lot of those kind of Street Fighter, like the Street Fighter 2 drums, how like incredibly fat and big they are, it was definitely kind of trying to have this type of a sound.
Yeah,
that's
and when
really
you listen to this,
point.
You realize like they did a really good job of mm-hmm. capturing that sound.
Yeah.
Well, and even like the synth instruments, like the arcade version of Street Fighter sounds so much like that intro. The ding, 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 like the synth instruments that they're using feel very much like what the arcade cabinets were able to produce in like Street Fighter and Final Fight and stuff.
So the last topic we're going to touch on today, we've talked about American film music. We're going to talk about Japanese film music in the form of one man, Joe Hisaishi. Now, his name has come up a lot on the podcast before. When we had our Yuzo Koshiro episode, we mentioned that he took composition lessons from Joe Hisaishi. Now, one thing that's really interesting about Joe is that he does a lot of work with, or he did a lot of work with Miyazaki, and Miyazaki just made some absolutely classic Japanese animated movies. We're going to play a couple songs from Laputa Castle in the Sky, which came out in the mid-80s. This first song is the main theme of Laputa. This is called The Girl Who Fell from the Sky.
Thank you.
This is The Girl Who Fell from the Sky from the movie Laputa Castle in the Sky, composed by Joe Hisaishi. And when you listen to this music, you really start to hear the influence of Joe Hisaishi and, in general, Japanese film music on, not surprisingly, Japanese video game composers. This was the music that was around. This was kind of floating in the atmosphere of this time. And when you think about Yuzo Koshiro as an example, we've played a lot of the music from the game Shenmue, and that is probably the most extreme example of the link between the music of Joe Hisaishi in the video game world. And actually, one fun fact is Joe Hisaishi did work on a very recent video game. There was a video game that came out for the PS3 that Studio Ghibli, which was the animation company, they actually worked on.
Yeah, so it's kind of nice to see this coming full circle. You know, Joe's music has been an influence on his peers that work in video games, and now, you know, it's come around so that he's contributing music for video games. It's pretty great.
Me personally, that theme though, that the girl who fell from the sky, just on a personal level, that's one of my all-time favorite melodies. It's just really beautiful, and I think it's ironic that now we're back here with Marty, but this is another one of the first songs that ever made me cry when I was really young, and it's a really effective melody because it, again, like we talked earlier, it really takes you on that dynamic range of emotions from just incredibly like a tragic melody, and then there's this slight air of like mystery, and then you have a slightly happier section, and it really takes you on an exaggerated series of emotions.
It definitely feels very Falcom-ish to me. I mean, you hear this type of influence in a lot of Falcom, a lot of PC-88 soundtracks, definitely.
So yeah, definitely listen to a lot of Joe's music. So if you're not familiar with Miyazaki's films, you know, this would include movies like My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke,
Spirited Away,
and so forth.
Yeah, so we're going to play one more song from the soundtrack. But the game that I was talking about earlier is called Ni no Kuni. That's the PS3 game that Joe worked on. So this last track from Laputa is called Shida's Decision. Let's take a listen. This is Shida's Decision from the soundtrack of Laputa Castle in the Sky, composed by the one and only Joe Hisaishi. And according to our friend Meng, this is actually Joe playing piano on this piece. So very, very beautiful performance and beautiful composition here. There's a track called Rain in the Shenmue soundtrack, and that track was composed by Yuzo Koshiro. And that just makes me smile because now I know for a fact that he studied with Joe Hisaishi. So it's really nice to hear his influence in the world of Japanese video game music.
Yeah, after that really sparse intro where it's only the melody unaccompanied, those lush chords that come in after that, they're so signature to Joe's writing, but they were also so influential among all his peers. And we do hear that kind of harmonic language in video game
and
music.
And another thing that is so present in Joe's music before that happened in video games was the use of that 9 over the minor 1, really long sustained 9 to give a little bit of sense of mystery and slight sadness, which you would hear. We talked about it in the Ease music all the time. So that's kind of another thing to note. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us today. This was a really fun time for all of us. I know it was kind of cool to put a little bit of our stamp on the world of video game music. It kind of felt like we were on a time machine going through music history, giving you a little bit of taste of some of the influences of video game music. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this.
Yeah, I think it's really important because when you read about the history of video game music, there's a lot of emphasis on the technology that's involved in the music. And that is really important. But, you know, this music wasn't created in the vacuum. It was written in the context of a lot of the music that we listen to today.
Right.
And when we start to put all of that together, you know, we really start to kind of appreciate this wonderful history of music that is the world's music.
Yeah, I mean, you could do this for almost any branch of music written for any entertainment media or just even just regular pop music in general. You can just keep going back and tracing the roots of what inspired something to what inspired that individual piece and just going back and back further and further. And I think it's really interesting to do it in the course of one episode, going back from the 12th century all the way.
Well, that's
what
I was just going to say, is one of the things that's so unique about video game music is everything we've played definitely has a reason to be on this episode. And I just think it's so cool that this might be one of the most diverse playlists of music of all time. I mean, going from medieval music to you know, Eye of the Tiger, it's just absolutely insane. But it's just cool that all of it is almost equally influential to video game music. So yeah, it's just a lot of fun that we got to include all that.
Right.
So as we wrap up the second season, we want to thank Marty again for joining us today. And we hope you guys stick with us next week for our season 2 finale. It's going to be a really exciting episode. We really look forward to it. So once again, keep sticking with us every Monday at the Super Mercado Brothers Video Game Music Podcast. Feel free to subscribe to us on iTunes, subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter.
So Carl, the music that we're going to play out with is pretty interesting and kind of a twist on today's theme.
Yeah, definitely, Marty. So what we're going to play out with is a track called Sweet, Sweet, Sweet by the Japanese pop band Dreams Come True. And Masato Nakamura, who composed the music of Sonic 1 and 2, was the bass player and songwriter of Dreams Come True. And what's so cool is that this song is the ending of Sonic 2. He also performed the song in his band Dreams Come True, and there's a female singer who sings it. So if you're familiar with the music of Sonic 2, you are just going to absolutely go crazy over this, because I guarantee you probably have not heard this before. So this is Sweet, Sweet, Sweet by the band Dreams Come True. Thanks so much for listening, guys. My name is Carl Brueggemann.
I'm Marty Brueggemann.
And I'm Will Brueggemann. Have a great week, you guys. Peace out.
See ya.